Richard Pryor changed comedy permanently, and he paved the way for comedians who were historically prohibited from a wider audience. He was larger than life and yet deeply flawed in several respects. It hasn't been easy over the last few years to try to capture Richard Pryor, but brothers Joe and David Henry have now written a new book entitled Furious Cool, Richard Pryor and the World That Made Him. Joe Henry joins us today. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Tell us a little bit about why you and your brother were fascinated with Richard Pryor.
Well, why we were, you know, when you're extremely young, you're susceptible to influence in a way that you never will be again because you don't know you're being influenced. You know, your doors and windows are wide open. And Richard sort of entered our lives when we were young enough not to really question why we were moved. We just knew that we were. And something about his incredibly vulnerable heart and his expansive humanity was utterly seductive to us.
I asked you about your influence, and this is a really broad question. We'll touch on it over the hour. But what were the influences on Richard Pryor that made him who he was?
Well, you understand that he grew up in Peoria, Illinois, which was a very unusual Midwestern town in that it had many more theaters than a typical city of that size would have. It was the perfect stop between St. Louis and Chicago on the old vaudeville circuit. So the old line, you know, will it play in Peoria, was real. You know, once we get out into the sticks, even though that it really was a city, not really the sticks, but it was not a major metropolis. And because so much theater was coming through there, Richard was exposed to, you know, and his grandmother, who raised him, ran a brothel. His grandfather ran a candy store and a pool hall. And entertainers of all sort would gather in both places. So from the time he was extremely young, you know, he was completely surrounded by people who were, in fact, entertainers of one sort or another, whether you're talking about the women who worked in the brothel or the you know, vaudeville comedians who hung out at the brothel late at night. He was influenced by a lot of performers beyond just the great mythologies that his family would unspool as stories and folklore of their, you know, family and times.
One of the things that was interesting, I think, you know, if you read a transcript of Richard Pryor, any given stand-up routine, you wouldn't think it would connect with as many people as it did, but he really did connect with an awfully wide audience, didn't he?
He did, in fact, and we talk a good bit about the fact that if you just read the text of his performances, especially, you know, when you got into the early 70s, mid-70s, his sort of zenith period. There's almost nothing remotely funny. It's absolutely heartbreaking, the words that he speaks, the characters that he embodies on stage. But, it, you know, his delivery was savagely funny, you know, what we refer to as the laugh of recognition. You know, people laughed because they recognized themselves and their world in what he was offering up. It wasn't just about entertaining people by making them laugh. It's about using laughter as a delivery system for some greater truths.
If you have a question about Richard Pryor, or maybe you had an experience where you had a chance, an opportunity to see one of his stand-up routines, I'd like to hear about that. Give us a call on the Jefferson Exchange, anywhere 800-838-3760 in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org. How did he change comedy? Was he the main one? I mean, there was other guys like Lenny Bruce and stuff, but did Richard Pryor, was he the main driving force in changing comedy?
Well, he did change everything. But, you know, we're quick to point out, and we believe, you know, pretty religiously, that this stuff doesn't come out of nowhere. You know, we liken Richard not so much to other comedians, but to people like Bob Dylan and Miles Davis and Charlie Parker and Muhammad Ali, for that matter, who, you know, arrived on their particular scene, putting elements together in a way that they'd never been assembled before. You can go back and look at where those elements came from. In Richard's case, you can look at, you know, the tall tales that he heard growing up, you know, in the barbershop, in the pool hall, in the brothel, the early African-American comedians that he saw, and then his exposure to people like Lenny Bruce, for instance, who was doing highly personalized material and not based on jokes. And you understand that these elements didn't come from nowhere, but Richard certainly put them together in a way that had never been assembled. And for and to be an African-American entertainer and brilliant mind in that moment, you know, to occupy the stage in a way that nobody else had been allowed to, was influential in itself. Almost anything he would have had to say once up on that platform would have been revelatory. But he was completely unique in the way that he, you know, really did approach every topic. Nothing was off limits. And, you know, the more personal for him, you know, the more riveting. You know, nobody had done that before, really.
He seemed to know just how far to push and rarely crossed that line. And it seems all the more remarkable being an African-American doing that kind of comedy back in the 60s and 70s. Was that just a sense of who he was? How did he know how far to push?
Well, I think, you know, there are times when he certainly did push a little too far. But certainly as far as mainstream America was concerned, you know, once he was, you know, on primetime television and hosting the Midnight Special on a Friday night, and certainly by the time he was hosting Saturday Night Live in its first, you know, very seminal and wildly influential season, you know, he was, you know, I guess the way to put it is he had a savage instinct, but what allowed it to really resonate for wide audiences in a way that nobody else had resonated, again, it was his incredible vulnerability. You know, he was able to say things to audiences, white and black, and not make anybody defensive. You know, somebody else uttering the same thing, you know, might have gotten hostility back, certainly would have. But, you know, he, you know, owned his own brokenness and his own vulnerability so completely that people didn't feel indicted by his observations. They felt invited into a conversation. And it's hard to overestimate the significance of that.
Joining us this morning is Joe Henry, along with his brother David. They have written a new book called Furious Cool, Richard Pryor and the World That Made Him. We're talking about the influences that Pryor had on an audience and those sort of questions. And if you'd like to participate, join us here on The Exchange. We'll give you the numbers in a moment. But first, we want to take a short break. Morning. We're discussing a new book entitled Furious Cool, Richard Pryor and the World That Made Him. Did Richard Pryor have an influence on you, his comedy routines, his outlook on the world? We'd like to hear from you anywhere in the state of Jefferson, 800-838-3760, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org. Joe Henry, I want to share with you, one of the famous skits from Saturday Night Live and ask you about this. It was the one with Chevy Chase where he's the interviewer and Richard Pryor is applying for a job as a janitor. And over the course of the interview, they do a word association, and that becomes progressively more racist throughout that word association, and Richard Pryor becomes progressively more angry with Chevy Chase and the questions he's asking. I looked at that almost as someone from that era as a type of comedy that could be done then. We have a certain amount of political correctness in our world today. Could a Richard Pryor himself or someone like him emerge and do that kind of comedy in the environment today, or was that really a product of the time and place?
Well, it certainly was a product of the time and place. I mean, we've talked about this considerably, that, you know, the atmosphere of the times that allowed Richard to exist and to be as influential as he was. I mean, things have really, really changed in the same way that if you look at, again, to use Bob Dylan as an analogy, you know, when he you know, left the folk movement and quote unquote went electric and angered his fans so much, who felt betrayed. You know, if that were to, you know, if the same thing were to be reenacted now, you know, people have too many other options. They're not invested in the same way that they used to be. People wouldn't have booed and been angry. They would have just walked out and gone to watch something else, or, you know, queued up something on YouTube. But people were invested in a different way because the times were so volatile. Not that they aren't now, but there are also so many fewer choices then. So I don't think that the architecture of our times would really allow a Richard to be the influence that he was, or allow anybody, any single performer, to be that culturally relevant in exactly the way that they were in that particular time. But, you know, keep in mind that when Richard and Chevy Chase did the skit that you're referring to, which was written by Richard's closest friend and longtime collaborator, the comedian Paul Mooney, you know, it was wildly controversial then, you know, and I think it would be today if somebody came out with that and nobody had seen it before. It would still be startling, even though we're supposedly living in a post-racial society. We're, of course, not. And, you know, I assume it would still be the topic of much conversation if that aired on live TV today.
In the context of those times that you're speaking of, what did he do for white America, for black America? Did his comedy help to improve race relations?
Well, I would say absolutely, because he was able to talk to both audiences. You know, he wasn't only playing in front of all black or all white audiences. By the time he'd really hit his mark in the early through the middle and later 70s, you know, his audiences, you know, both on TV and in theaters, you know, those were very integrated audiences. And he was allowed to share things that, or he did share things that were not only significant to either race, but significant to our humanity. It invited people to see themselves not as white or black, but as human beings. And again, there's nothing more subversive than that. And it's also really hard to overestimate the power of that in that moment. Somebody who was able to stand on a stage and in a very personal way, you know, address, you know, both communities, and people loved him for it instead of, you know, being angry for it, because, you know, he owned so much of his own brokenness that people weren't defensive about it. They didn't feel indicted. They felt, you know, respected in a way that he would actually bring them into a conversation about anything and everything.
He was very honest, wasn't he, throughout that whole period?
Well, it seems that he was more honest on stage than he was able to be anywhere else in his life. I mean, we talk in the book on a number of occasions about the significance of being able to stand on stage and have the kind of clarity about human nature that he had, and the fact that it wasn't diminished just because he couldn't live by that same enlightenment when he was off stage. You know, he wasn't able to apply all that wisdom and clarity to his own personal life. That doesn't mean he wasn't able to offer it up, you know.
We're talking this morning with Joe Henry. He and his brother David are the authors of a new book called Furious Cool. It's about the life of Richard Pryor and the influences that he had here on America. If you have a question, give us a call at 800-838-3760. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Or you can email us at jx@jeffnet.org. In addition, if you were influenced by Pryor, had an opportunity maybe to see one of his concerts or something, we'd love to hear from you. Joe, I'd like you to compare the 60s, 70s Richard Pryor with the 80s Richard Pryor?
Well, for me, and I know David agrees with me on this, you know, the Pryor that most people are, you know, remember from the 80s, you know, if you ask a random person who's not been deeply invested in his work and what it meant to the culture about Richard, you know, they may say, oh, yeah, I loved Brewster's Millions. I loved The Toy. You know, for me personally, the Richard that was on stage and on film in the 80s was a bit of an imposter from the man that he had been. You know, he got so deep into drug addiction and self-loathing that, you know, his artistry took a significant back seat. to the big money that he was offered. You know, I think anybody, you know, trying to keep a vision going, you know, you get offered more and more money to do less and less significant work. You know, you keep saying yes, thinking, well, I'll take, you know, this is a lousy movie, somebody else's script, I'll take the money and then I'll be more independent for the next one. And Richard had so many people dependent on him, and his drug addiction was so savage, as we know. You know, he never did get back to really owning his own artistic voice once he got into the big money and the big drugs of the 80s.
We have a caller that wanted to know if he had an influence on some future comedians like Eddie Murphy or other people.
Oh, without question. I mean, Eddie Murphy would not exist as we have seen him without Richard, and he has owned that from the beginning. Likewise, Chris Rock and Louis C.K. and Dave Chappelle, you know, by no means only African-American comedians. I mean, Jerry Seinfeld has said fairly famously, you know, Richard was, you know, our business is, you know, our industry is Picasso. And you'd have to, you know, you'd have to go back from the 80s into the 60s and 70s to understand why he would say that. So, you know, back to your earlier question, too, about comparing the Richard of the 80s with the 60s and the 70s. You know, the Richard of the late 60s got sort of radicalized, you know, after spending a short amount of time trying to be a Bill Cosby imitator, because he recognized that Bill was going to be wildly successful, and he said they were only going to let one African-American comedian in through the, you know, the front door one at a time. And if he was going to be successful, he needed to do what Bill was doing, and he tried that for a while. You know, a very, you know, folksy and friendly material made for TV. But very quickly, after he'd spent some time in Berkeley and he was spending time with the Black Panthers and studying the speeches of Malcolm X and listening to Miles Davis and Marvin Gaye, he sort of got radicalized and felt like, you know, he had to do something that was relevant, not just funny. And that Richard that emerged at the end of the late 60s and influenced by Lenny Bruce as well, and his very personal and aggressive stance allowed Richard to sort of become the character that we now recognize as being so influential, so brilliant, as he was all through the 70s.
I'm wondering how history will remember Richard Pryor. I mean, in his early comedy days, of course, we didn't have people with camera phones uploading to YouTube. And then in the later part of his career, he did do a handful of pretty dreadful movies. I mean, are people unfortunately going to remember the later Richard Pryor instead of the early one?
Well, that's one reason that we wanted to write the book, is that it was really obvious to us that so many people just, you know, oh, I love Richard, and they were referencing, you know, the work in the 80s that you know, that was not, you know, really his work. He was following the pace and the direction of a director, reading somebody else's script, having to observe the patterns of, you know, other actors. That's not what was great about Richard. You got to be willing to peel back the onion and see, you know, why he was given those kind of mainstream roles. You know, what had he done that had made him so relevant and so bankable? I think there is a danger that the work towards the latter part of his life has overshadowed what was so revelatory and pivotal in his early days. But I do think history has a way of sorting these things out. I mean, people, you know, in the 70s, I referenced Louis Armstrong, you know, who was a revolutionary as a musician. He changed things for everybody. You know, I'm a musician first and foremost. That's my day job. And I'll tell you that Louis Armstrong changed the landscape for everybody, whether you know it or not. But people who only saw him as an old man in the 70s, like on the Merv Griffin show in the afternoon singing Hello, Dolly, if that's all you know of Louis Armstrong, you wouldn't understand that he was a revolutionary. You got to be willing to go back. But I think people will, and I think people are. It's human nature to, you know, once the novelty of the moment recedes, that we want to go back and look at why stuff that matters has mattered.
Let's talk a little bit about his demons. How did that influence him, both in a positive and a negative way as well?
Well, I would say it has to be, you know, primarily negative. I mean, it took so much of his energy away so much of his focus. I mean, his dear friend, again, Paul Mooney, is quoted as saying that, you know, Richard was a junkie first and a genius second. And, you know, though it really came down to it, you know, his artistry took a back seat to his addiction. And that's, you know, a painful truth. So, you know, at a certain point, it's not only difficult, it's impossible to separate elements of someone's life and work that way. You know, if you could say, you know, would he have been as great a comedian and as relevant, you know, had he taken better care of himself? We can't know because, you know, it may be, in fact, you know, though not recommended, it may be true that the fact that he was able to value his life, his own life, so little is what made him so fearless. You know, I hate to psychoanalyze him. I don't have the chops to do that. But I do know that it's at a certain point impossible to exorcise the demons and not possibly exorcise the angels as well.
What kind of relationship did he have with individuals? He seemed just, like you say, to just naturally get into the flow of an audience. How was he in his personal relationships?
Well, I guess the short answer to that story is that he was terrible. He was wildly unreliable as a family member, as a friend, as a collaborator. And yet the people that we spoke to, everybody still had so much love for him. You know, people would tell us the most, you know, horrific stories about, you know, how, you know, Richard had, you know, had betrayed them, disappointed them. And then at the end of it would just say, you know, but you just loved him. We'd do anything for him, you know, because he was so tender-hearted. He was so big-hearted, ultimately. You know, he was just, you know, the walking wounded. And as we know, you know, those people might offer up great insight and great art, but they're not necessarily the easiest people to abide with day to day.
In the latter part of his life and his sickness, how did he handle that?
Well, he kept pushing. I mean, that's absolutely true. And he did continue to try to find a way to work and perform, because that's what he knew. I mean, that was his link to sanity in some ways. That's what gave his life, you know, a focus and a framework. But again, you know, by the time that he was clearly ravaged by MS and the long-term effects of sustained drug abuse, you know, he was sort of beyond himself, and in some ways, it seems Richard even looked at himself as other people. You know, he was influenced by the Richard Pryor that we all know, though not any more able to be him any more than anybody else who would like to have imitated him. You know, even in his own semi-autobiographical film that Richard made called Jojo Dancer, Your Life is Calling. You know, when he's acting in a movie as Richard Pryor, doing Richard Pryor routines, he's not very good. He's not any better at imitating Richard than anybody else is.
We have Jamie on the line from Medford. Go ahead, Jamie.
Yes, good morning, guest, and good morning, host. I wanted to make a comment, and the comment is this. I thought that routine that in the seminal seasons of Saturday Night Live was the most right-on thing that epitomized him, because the look on his face when he comes back with the final line of that skit is just hilarious. And he truly epitomized, literally, the off-color jokester, in which he actually imitates a white guy during one of his stand-ups, and that too was truly mind-blowingly funny. I wanted to ask the guest, had he ever met Red Fox, and what did he think of Gene Wilder when they did those cheesy 80s movies? And I'll take the answer off the phone.
Thank you, Jamie.
Sure, thank you. Well, yeah, he was very close to Red Fox. I mean, Red Fox was a huge influence on him in the early days. You know, Red, who had come out of the vaudeville days and through the what was referred to as the Chitlin circuit, right into the nightclub years, and then Red owned a very influential, very important comedy club in downtown Los Angeles. You know, through the 50s and 60s, that was frequented by almost exclusively African Americans, but it was a seminal proving ground for black comics in America, in Los Angeles. You know, Red was a big influence not only on Richard, but in the way that the nightclub years developed into the late, the early 60s. So no question about that. And as to your second question was about, I just lost the thread of his second question.
Oh, about Gene Wilder and that.
About Gene Wilder.
And the movie.
You know, Richard didn't think very much of the movies they made together, even though they were wildly successful. In fact, when the motion picture company put him out to promote the film, I think it was Stir Crazy. You know, Richard out there on the stump campaigning for the life of the film, you know, tells journalists, you know, he apologizes to his fans, said, you know, I did it for the money. I know people like the film, but I can't. I watched it and I just, you know, I don't see it. So I think that ultimately, you know, he felt that those were regrettable artistic choices. And it seems that maybe he, you know, he just sort of looked at Gene in some regard as just, you know, part of a bad choice. Not personally, but the work that he had done with Gene represented something to Richard that appeared to feel like a distraction.
We're discussing the new book, Furious Cool, Richard Pryor and the World That Made Him, written by David and Joe Henry. And we're going to take a short break. You can join the conversation with any of your questions about Richard Pryor anywhere, 800-838-3760, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org. We'll be back with the rest of our conversation right after this. Discussing the book Furious Cool, Richard Pryor and the World That Made Him, my guest this morning, Joe Henry, who along with his brother David Henry wrote this book about Richard Pryor's life. 800-838-3760, Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org. If you have an observation about Richard Pryor, or you maybe had a chance to see him in concert, or what you think of his movies, give us a call. Joe, I wanted to ask a follow-up question on Gene Wilder. I mean, despite the fact that some of those movies were not so good, they seemed to have just a fabulous chemistry on camera. Did they have that in real life? Were they friends outside of the business?
No, it doesn't seem like they were. It seems like that was a... I don't want to say it was a marriage of convenience, but they certainly did have something together on screen that was quite alluring to people. I mean, they did have a great chemistry, but they didn't socialize outside of that. But also, I think worth commenting on the fact that, you know, it's not well known, but, you know, Richard made as many movies, with Gene Wilder, as he made with, anybody. And their union is very galvanized in people's minds. People are going to forever associate them because those movies were so, had gone so widescreen, you know, as far as popularity, mm-hmm. that it's invariable that people think of them together. And probably imagine, like you were just, that, you know, that they had a more sustained professional relationship than just those few movies. But Richard also made a number of movies with Billy Dee Williams,
mm-hmm.
Just as many as he made with Gene Wilder, as a matter of fact. And there was a great chemistry between them, you know, but those movies didn't have the mainstream appeal, as the broad comedy of an African American and a white star together.
Was he ever, especially in the later years, and you look at those movies, I mean, I've wondered, was he unsure of himself, as artists sometimes are? On one hand, you're, you are, as you're performing, you know, you're confident, But then you, in the back of your mind, you're thinking, am I a success or not? Was that one of the demons that he had to deal with?
Oh, very real, I think. I think your observation is right on. I mean, you know, most any great artist, you know, would own the fact that, in their secret hearts, they all believe that they're phonies and they're just waiting to be discovered. You know, Richard quite clearly had self-esteem issues. So much self-loathing involved in his abuse. Even when he was the highest paid, certainly the highest paid African American performer in America, and one of the most one of the highest paid entertainers, period. But I don't think he ever really believed it. You know, I always think he felt like he was getting away with something, as so many artists do. So there's certainly an element of self-doubt that's, nipping at his heels, constantly.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about the mechanics of writing the book. Hopefully this isn't too personal because you're an artist yourself, a musician. Your book kind of has an interesting cadence to it as I read through it. It almost has a sort of musical feel. It's a little bit different than your typical biography. Was that your guys' approach? Is that your influence that you and your brother have?
Well, you know, it wasn't that we set about with that as a conscious goal, to make it musical, though, I am a musician first and foremost, and even though David is not a practicing musician, my brother is someone for whom, music is a huge part of his, his life, and the way he processes it. We certainly imagined that it could not be, at least from us, a traditional biography. We're not those kind of writers. I certainly don't understand long-form book architecture in the same way that my brother does. Most of what I do is contained on a single page, once I've written it. But we did want to make it sprawling and messy in the way that we found Richard to be, as an artist, to be sprawling and his life messy. It couldn't just be a chronological linear story. And we weren't just trying to tell Richard's story. We were trying to look at the world that he walked out of. We all have an idea of who he was and what he became. But, out of what landscape did he emerge, and what about the times that allowed him to happen and be as significant as he was? But as far as you asking about the tone of the book, part of that by its nature is just our shared sensibility, but also the fact that we were trading chapters back and forth. My brother lives in Louisville, Kentucky, and I live in Los Angeles. We got together a number of times over the course of the couple of years we spent writing the book. But so much of it was done just passing things back and forth through email. I'd write on something until I hit a wall, and then I would throw it to David, and he would completely reimagine what I'd been working on, and vice versa. So I think there's a sprawl to it and a fragmentation to it that we courted, thinking it was appropriate.
Besides the mechanics of writing the book together, I've just got to wonder what it's like writing a book with a sibling. That seems like something that could go horribly wrong.
Well, you're not the first person to suggest that, but my brother David's been my closest friend in life outside of my wife and children. We work really well together. We had not one disparaging word between us. I mean, that's just a fact. I know that wouldn't be the case with everybody writing a book with their brother or sister, but any time David took something I wrote and radically reimagined it, nobody was happier than me. I never felt one moment of defensiveness against my brother on behalf of what I'd written. I much more default to David's point of view if he were to challenge mine, because I have so much respect for him as a thinker and as a writer.
Our subject today, Furious Cool, the new book about Richard Pryor and the world that made him. We're speaking with Joe Henry, one of the authors, along with his brother, David Henry. I had a question on, as you were doing research for the book and you were talking to different people about, let's say, any specific episode in Richard's life, it seems like with complex people, they're often perceived quite differently, the same experience that someone might have had. Was that Richard's case? He seems like a complex kind of guy.
Well, he had to be a complex character, though. He was by no means, always funny, we talked to a number of people who would just say, he was actually sort of, you know, when he wasn't on stage or in front of even like a house full of hangers-on where he would be sort of on anyway, if he was just by himself, you know, with a wife or girlfriend, he was reported to be fairly boring and shy and sort of withdrawn, you know, probably thinking a good bit about, you know, what he intended to do. I mean, he did have an incredibly tough work ethic, even though he didn't work in very organized fashion compared to some other artists. You know, he did hone his skills incredibly. He worked really hard at what he was doing. But he was not a laugh a minute to be around, as we find out from, you know, most significant comedians. You know, whether it's W.C. Fields or Jackie Gleason, anybody who's been, you know, sort of at the forefront of a revolution as far as comic minds are concerned, weren't necessarily regarded to be funny people outside of their work.
From his same era, I read that one time about Steve Martin as well, that he could be very reclusive when he's, you know, just in his downtime. We have a caller from Mount Shasta. Sandy, go ahead, Sandy.
Yeah, hi. Wow, what a great book to look forward to reading. And Joe, I love your music.
Thank you.
I think Richard, kind of, for me, he kind of personifies the kind, there are certain African-American artists that he's a kind of a personification of that. For me, growing up in the 60s as a pretty alienated young white guy who felt probably as oppressed by the power structure as many minorities did not identify with it at all. People like Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali, whom I first knew as Cassius Clay, and then Richard. These are all guys who had the guts to stand up and speak truth to power, to a white establishment that I just loved it. I just absolutely loved it, and they all were great inspirations to me.
I completely agree with you, Sandy, you know, especially in terms of Malcolm. I think, you know, Malcolm X understood the landscape of our culture through the 50s and the 60s in this country as almost nobody else did. And also worth mentioning that, you know, it was significant to Richard, who spent a lot of time poring over Malcolm's speeches. But if you listen to recordings of Malcolm X speaking, he was an incredible public speaker and wickedly funny as well. Incredible sense of rhythm and time completely focused and challenging, but again, really funny. You know, if you listen to recordings of his speeches, there are great outbursts of laughter constantly. And again, it's the laugh of recognition, because Malcolm was speaking truth, and what is funny is what we recognize to be true. So, you know, Malcolm and Ali, both incredibly significant figures of that time. And as I said earlier on, I'm much more inclined to put Richard on the landscape with Malcolm and Ali and Miles and Bob Dylan than I am to try to rate him with other comedians. Because I think what's significant about Richard is completely transcendent of his role as a quote-unquote comedian.
I know that in some of his comments, some of his jokes, some of his lines, incredibly profound in a short amount of space, you know. And
sure.
I'm trying to think of the one where he said, and I can't do it any justice, but where he said, I had an opportunity to be white and I refused.
Yeah.
And, you know, you, at one hand, if you hear that line, you laugh at it, and then you think a little bit about it and you realize how deep some of those go.
Oh, absolutely true. I mean, so much of what feels tossed off, you know, in a performance, in a line like that, which goes by as just on its surface, you know, wickedly funny and only funny until you start to dismantle the thought behind it and you know, realize how, you know, how sharp that blade was.
Did Richard Pryor change the world? I mean, that's kind of a broad question, but did he have a lasting influence?
Oh, without question. And sure, you can ask the question if he changed the world. I think he absolutely did. If he changed the way, you know, that a big part of a generation saw itself and saw itself in context to others, if you've influenced that, you've influenced everything.
In addition to your book, do you have some recommendations on how people can get to know Richard Pryor in a broader sense?
Well, sure. I mean, if anybody asked me, you know, hey, where do I enter the stream if I want to find out something about Richard's genius, I send everybody, you know, straight to the original film, from 1979 in Long Beach. It's still the greatest bit of stand-up ever filmed. You know, one man on a stage with a microphone for an hour and 10 minutes. And it's impossible to miss.
Did Richard Pryor, you know, I know I've read that some comedians would just spend hours and hours writing and crafting their lines, and others just sort of got up a stream of consciousness. How did he approach the mechanics of preparing for a comedy stand-up routine?
Well, I think Richard worked very much like Charlie Parker, the great alto saxophonist, revolutionary jazz musician, would talk about, you know, practice really hard so that when you get up on stage, you can forget all of it. It's clear that Richard worked really hard crafting, you know, his routines, but when he got up to deliver them, he was very free. I mean, if you listen, like the concert film that I just referenced, Live in Concert, if you listen to the live album from that same tour called Wanted, you know, you can hear that he's doing the same routines, but in no way is he just memorized an act and reading it into the public record. You know, he is performing, he is being spontaneous, he's improvising within the framework of very solid routines that he's clearly developed, you know, over a great period of time. Though he does get up there and is as free of the restraints of what he's written as you could possibly imagine.
In the short time we have left, what did you, in writing the book, you talked about your experiences early on with discovering Richard Pryor, like many of us did. What did you learn that was really significant that maybe changed you in the course of your research for this?
Well, I'm not sure what would have changed me in the, you know, from what I already felt and believed about Richard, except that, you know, any fear that anyone might have had on my behalf that I would have, if I read too much about him, if I learned too much about him, I would stop loving him. That did not happen. I just came away with more respect for how much great work he did, considering how difficult his life was and how difficult he made it. I mean, with all the, you know, the hardship of his upbringing, you know, the abuse, the physical and sexual abuse that he experienced as a child, his own wicked drug abuse, it's startling to understand how disciplined he really was as an artist and how much he really accomplished in a short time. You know, that's probably what I was consciously most surprised by that I hadn't really considered before. It's just a, you know, you wonder how he did, you know, so much good work when things were so treacherous.
Mind-boggling. Well, thank you, Joe Henry, for being here this morning with your book, Furious Cool, that you co-wrote with your brother, David Henry. And by the way, keep up the good work on your music as well.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
That's it for The Exchange today. You can find out more about the program and suggest guests at jeffexchange.org. We also have a Facebook page and some links on Twitter. If you're listening in the morning, The Takeaway is up next. If you're listening to the evening broadcast, we'll have news from the BBC. Tomorrow on The Exchange, Jeff Riley returns. The producer is Charlotte Duran. I'm Milt Radford. Thanks for listening.